to Multiverse Musings, a DC Comics podcast, episode 10. I'm your host, Adam, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Jordan. Jordan, how's it going?
Man, it is going great, man. By the time the listeners hear this, we will be in a post-Justice League world, but what that means right now is that as we're recording, we are just a few days away from Justice League, and I am so excited. I couldn't be better, man. How about you?
I'm good. We're, what is it, 4 days away is my countdown clock suggests, and you know, I know some people, as we talked about off air, I know some there are some screenings that are going on right now as we record this. People are seeing it, and I'm kind of jealous about that. Having said that, we have a good consolation prize in being able to rewatch and review Wonder Woman.
No, yes, indeed.
Wonder Woman is no consolation prize because it was a fantastic movie, but I don't want to spoil my overall rating of the film just yet. As we have with all the DC films that are leading up to Justice League, well, not all of them, but I think since Man of Steel, we've been lucky enough to have a guest join us to talk about these films. And you found us a guest for this one, correct?
I did. Yeah, I did indeed.
Why don't you introduce our guest?
Yeah, well, joining us tonight to discuss Wonder Woman is a good friend of mine, Cammy from the Arrow Squad podcast. So usually she talks about Arrow, but I wanted to bring her on for a change of pace tonight because I asked her if she wanted to talk about Arrow, and we decided that it would be fun to have a change of pace, and she's going to come on and talk Wonder Woman with us. So yeah, introduce yourself to the listeners, Cammy.
Hi, thanks for having me, guys. My name is Cammy. I'm very excited to talk about Wonder Woman. I do love talking about Arrow. As Jordan mentioned, I'm a co-host on Arrow Squad. But, you know, I might just like Wonder Woman even more than Arrow. So I'm pretty excited to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, Cammy. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Why do I feel like this is the first time that I'm finding out that she has her own podcast, that now I want to listen to it? Why didn't you tell me about this earlier? Or maybe...
Did I not?
You know what it is? It's either you didn't tell me, or I tuned you out because I thought you were talking about Thirst again, the Smallville episode. But Cammy, just to get a little bit of background, how did you meet Jordan? How do you know Jordan?
Well, Jordan and I actually met at a Wonder Woman panel at Dragon Con this year. I was one of the panelists at a fan panel at Dragon Con, which is a convention in Atlanta on Labor Day. All things, you know, kind of nerdy and comic-y and stuff. And Jordan was there in the front row, and he had a lot of good thoughts to share about Wonder Woman and all the DC films. And we just found ourselves talking afterwards, and then we just sort of absorbed him into our crew. We adopted him for the weekend, one might say.
I see. Now, before you guys all, like, you know, got to know him and accepted him into your group, did he happen to mention to you that he enjoys Batman and Robin and Catwoman?
He may have mentioned that. In fact, if I remember correctly, when we met, there was a non-zero number of Batman merch on your person at every point during that weekend. Yeah,
that is true. I feel like now we've got to tell the Batman v Superman story, though.
Oh, goodness. We did, you know, maybe that's a story left. That's left for another day. But we did put him through the ringer a bit when it came to some of his favorite movies and favorite moments. But, you know, we all found common ground on our love of Wonder Woman and, you know, just our love of DC in general.
Great segue.
I'll vouch for you on BVS, but I'm not helping you out on Catwoman and or Batman and Robin. You're on your own. Yeah, I actually, when I was looking for a co-host, because I used to have another podcast before this one, and on that podcast, I always used to say, when discussing my hatred for Batman and Robin, that there had to be one person in the universe that enjoyed that movie, and I was happy that somebody found enjoyment out of the movie. And then when I started conversing with Jordan, he told me, well, you know, Batman and Robin is not that bad. And after taking a couple of drinks of alcohol, just to keep myself sane, I said, well, you know what? This would make an interesting dynamic for a podcast. You want to be my co-host? And so part of his crazy movie taste got him the gig. but still doesn't mean I have to tolerate his discussion of it. Before we get going, I just want to ask you a couple of questions. What is your, okay, if you had to choose, and it doesn't have to be DC, like connected universe or DC mm-hmm. films universe, what is your favorite DC film?
I mean, it's going to sound so cliche given that we're talking about Wonder Woman, but it's Wonder Woman. That's the answer. You know, I wish I had some cool niche old movie to reference, you know, and sound really cool and educated in DC lore, but the truth is it's Wonder Woman, most recent version. Yeah.
Right. And favorite character, is it also Wonder Woman or?
Okay, if we're including characters that aren't necessarily a part of the movie or a part, like a part of the current cinematic universe,
Any character,
or
any DC character,
characters from the comic books, I do love the whole Oracle, Barbara Gordon type of, in any incarnation of hers, fun, but I don't know. I mean, Wonder Woman's up there. Whatever I list, yeah. Wonder Woman would still probably be tied with it, regardless.
Of course, yeah. That's good. So now, with all that intro out of the way, before we get to actually talking about the awesomeness that is Wonder Woman,
yeah.
there is some news. And
there is.
First, we're going to start with, I'm going to change things up just to throw Jordan off his game when he's editing. We're going to start with animation. Well, it's movie and animation. It's an animated movie. Go figure how that works. The trailer for the next DC, DCAU? What's the initials on that? Is that right, Jordan?
Wait, it's funny you say that. The initials are DCUAOM. However, they keep shortening it. So after a while, they changed it to just DCU. No, sorry, DCOM. And then they changed it. Actually, this is the first movie because they released the box art for the movie we're about to talk about. And they just shortened it again to just, I think on the box art for this one, it just says DC Original Movie. So they keep shortening it, but I still call it the DCU AOM line. So it's the most recent release. It's the upcoming release in that.
That's all too complicated for me. I'm just going to call it a DC Animated Movie. And the next one is based on Batman Gotham by it is called Batman Gotham by Gaslight. It's based on the Elseworlds title of the same name. From what I know, it's rated R according to the trailer. They released the trailer, and general impressions. As I'm going to do throughout the night, I'm going to defer to our guest co-host tonight, Cammy. What did you think of this trailer, and do you have any experience with the original graphic novel?
I'll answer your last question first. No, not really. And what did I think of the trailer? I thought that looked so fun. You know, I'm way more into the live action incarnations than anything. I know that's a pretty basic answer, but that the trailer was really fun. I really liked the you know, it still felt dark. It still felt DC. It still felt like something, even if you're not a huge animation version fan, you'd still like it. I quite enjoyed it. And the setting and premise looked fun. So,
Jordan?
I'm in agreement. Gotham by Gaslight is one of my favorite comics, actually. And for me, what this trailer did was I really felt like it captured the tone of the comic, and it's also a really suspenseful comic. And I mean, it's hard to discern how much of that is going to come through in the movie just from this trailer. But really, the way they staged this trailer, really, I felt like a little bit of that suspense came through, and I really feel like I'm very happy with what I'm seeing so far from this movie. In fact, what I'll go ahead and say right now is that if this movie is as good as it looks right now, and if my anticipation level for it is winds up being warranted, this could wind up being my favorite release in the DCU AOM line. I will say that, like I said, it's already one of my favorite comics of all time. But now they're including or they're incorporating Selina Kyle into the story because she wasn't in the comic, and everybody knows how big a Catwoman fan I am, so I'm really happy about that. It looks like we got some glimpses of some Bat-Cat scenes in this trailer, so that excites me a lot. So hopefully there's some of that in the movie. And also we've got Bruce Greenwood returning as Batman, and I think he's one of the best Batman voice actors that there is out there. And so it's we'll probably be hearing him again in Young Justice season 3 when that hits next year. But to get him here as well, I think that's awesome. So what did you think, Adam?
Well, this this comic, first of all, is one of my favorite Batman stories, period. The idea of Batman in a period piece, you know, Victorian London era Gotham, which kind of doesn't sort of jive because, you know, Victorian era London and then throwing Gotham in there, it's kind of counterintuitive. But that setting plus Batman taking on Jack the Ripper, I mean, just take my money. The story was fantastic. It was one of those ones that I didn't know about when I my re-entry into comic books. I was given three books to sort of hook me onto comics again, and it was Dark Knight Returns. It was the Superman Batman team up title by Jeff Loeb, and then it was this one was another one that I was given, and so based on again Batman versus Jack the Ripper, and I'm sold because it sounds like an odd pairing, but it works. And visually, you're right. It from what I recall from the book, it captures the visual aesthetic of the book quite well. The art in that book was by Mike Mignola, which is the Hellboy creator. And the art style meshes with him and with his well. And like you said, Bruce Greenwood, he also did Under the Red Hood, correct? Am I correct?
He did. He did, yeah.
And so I liked him in that one. I, of course, loved him in Young Justice. I can't wait for season three of that. I need an announcement on a date. By the way, Warner Brothers, if you're listening, which you're not. Can I pre-order it? Like, is it available for pre-order yet? Because I just want to pre-order it at this point. Like,
I'm ready. You know, I don't think so. In fact, I don't even think we have a specific date on that yet. But I will comment on that, because if you look at the sort of the pattern that they've done with these films in the past, it would be pretty safe to assume that it's going to be a very early 18 release. My guess is that they'll do digital release in January, and then the physical will be out in February.
Yeah, but I'm still old school physical media guy. I'm not that much older than you, Jordan, but I still like my physical copy of things. I'm getting on board the digital comics train because I'm running out of space, but it's out of necessity, not because I want to.
But I actually love digital comics.
I like them. There's just something about holding the thing in your hand. Now, I will say this. The organizing of comic books and putting them away is something I won't miss. But that's about the only thing I won't miss, because I curse myself whenever I have to organize them. I'm not too happy with the amount I buy, and then I'm like, what do I now? I got to put all this crap away. So it is better in the long run. I'm just taking a long time to get used to it. So adding movies to that list of things to get used to, I'm not quite there yet.
I got into digital comics when I was off at college in the middle of nowhere, and there was no comic book shop particularly close to me. So that's where I got hooked on digital comics, and then I never went back. So I don't know. I've gone digital with my movies too, though. That's the funny thing. I've sort of gone all completely digital. So I'm sort of the opposite.
I'm fully digital with movies, TV, comics, even books as much as possible. With a couple exceptions, I'll buy a physical copy of a book. But I really do prefer digital for everything.
Warner Brothers can convince me to go digital really easy. Send me a copy of Justice League in my email. I promise them I'll go digitally permanently. We're good. Like, I'll sign that contract right now. I'll sign any non-disclosure agreement you want. But that's not going to happen. And so I'll just abandon that dream. While we patiently or impatiently wait for Justice League, let's further hype ourselves for it by discussing Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman was the, dare I say, and I will say it, the best movie of the summer for me this past summer. And I saw a unusual amount of movies this summer. Like, usually I don't go to as many as I went this summer, but for some reason it's like, okay, I think part of it was like, I need to kill time until Justice League. And so let me go see a bunch of summer movies. And Wonder Woman was the one that stood out as the, and it was, let's be honest, it was my most anticipated, because I think wherever we fall, the three of us, on our opinions of Batman versus Superman, I think it's fair to say that Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman stole the show. And I think we'll all agree on that. Am I wrong on that, Cammy? Did I?
Oh, no, we agree. I just didn't want to interrupt, but yes, absolutely. She did a lovely job.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I just want to make sure. I just assume everybody liked her because that's the vibe I got. But I mean, one of the reasons why I was so happy that this thing was even more successful than people predicted was, just before we get into the movie itself, was all the background drama in the lead up to the release with, you know, it started with Gal Gadot's casting, mm-hmm. where you had the typical, I have a nickname for, I probably didn't come up with this. I'm taking credit for something that I probably heard somewhere, but for the members of fandom who are quick to judge anything sight unseen, or because an actress or an actor doesn't fit a weight or muscle requirement, or in this case, it was as ridiculous as it sounds, breast size, quote unquote, requirement. Mm-hmm. And they jump on message boards and, oh, she's terrible and she can't act and she's never going to look like an Amazon. So all the crap that Gal Gadot had to put up with upon her initial casting, just on that basis alone, I'm like, thank goodness for the success of this movie, just to shove it in the face of what I call the basement dwellers, who basically, you know, they jump up, because they have a keyboard in front of them, and they have platforms like Twitter, and they can say and do whatever they want, and they have no common sense is my first go-to. So
for those, there's something about the anonymity, I suppose, of being online that gives everybody sort of this false sense of being able to portray themselves as an expert, right? So somebody who perhaps in real life would never, you know, criticize an actress or an actor's physical appearance, you know, quite that severely, because we can see them in real life and we're like, well, you're one to speak, you know, you don't look like Wonder Woman or Superman either, right?
Right.
With that anonymity, it sort of allows somebody to be impervious to any backlash or criticism in response, and they're just allowed to sort of throw their anger or self-righteousness out there, which is unfortunate. And of course, we see that elevated and escalated when it comes to a female-led franchise.
Right. And just to stick it – well, not just to, but in part to stick it to those kind of like negative people – I was so happy that the film achieved as much as it did.
Mm-hmm.
Also because, you know, and it went further. It was like everybody was complaining. They're not, then when we finally started getting promos and stuff, they're not marketing it enough. And it's going to be the lowest grossing DC movie at the box office and all this other crap. And it's like every week when I watched this succeed and I saw the reviews and just the fact that general audience were loving it and everybody was, you know, falling in love with Gal Gadot and all that stuff. It just made – it was one of those movies that the success – now, look, I have nothing – I wasn't involved in making this movie. I don't have the talent for that. But as a fan of DC and as Wonder Woman being as important as she is, it's one of these scenarios where seeing the film do as well as it did, it just put a smile on my face.
I think there's – you know, there's really – you know, there's two kinds of people. There's those who – get joy out of seeing things succeed, right? Because we're wanting to succeed in our own creative endeavors or whatever. And because we have that goal and that determination, we also see that and celebrate that in others. And then there's those who only feel sort of happiness when others don't succeed. You know, they celebrate failure. They almost take joy in it because, you know, they're not celebrating their own successes, or they don't have their own successes, or they don't have that determination, so they can only feel better about themselves if somebody else fails. So I really think when it came to Wonder Woman, that really became clear when it came to like fandom and critics and whatever, mm-hmm. seeing those who were pleasantly it was a success. Like, numerically, it was a success. Critically, it was a success. Why can I not say the word success? That's so odd. Anyway.
It's not only you. It's a difficult word every once in a while.
Yeah. So it was kind of undeniably a success. But watching everybody's response to that was really enlightening, to see where people were coming at and how they were kind of viewing the work, how they were viewing their place as a critic, whether it was to celebrate a win or a failure. And I think that reveals a lot about a character too.
Right. And you know, for a movie that everybody said, or at the outset, some people said wasn't being marketed, and the people questioning, can Gal Gadot carry her own franchise? It got a sequel announcement pretty quickly, which segues into the news that I forgot. And that was, originally, Wonder Woman 2 was scheduled for December 13th, 2019.
Right.
But then Star Wars decided to put Episode 9 a week later, on December 20th. So Warner Brothers had the good sense to move Wonder Woman away from that. And now, I'm not saying, before anybody that's listening freaks out, I'm not saying I don't think Wonder Woman couldn't make money against something like Star Wars. She could make money, and she probably would, for sure. But if you're a film studio like Warner Brothers, why would you handcuff your ability to profit against another mammoth, you know, geek-led franchise such as Star Wars? I mean, it doesn't make good business sense. So I think Warner Brothers made the right decision in moving Wonder Woman 2. And the even better thing for us as DC fans is that they've moved it earlier. So what was what was December 13th is now going to be November 1st, 2019. So plan your whatever accordingly, put in your schedule, and be ready for Wonder Woman 2. Now,
so what you're saying is Wonder Woman 2 is arriving just in time for my birthday.
Oh, is that close to your birthday?
Right around then is my birthday. It's a couple days after, but you know what? I'm going to take it anyways.
it's Warner Brothers' early birthday present to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Warner Brothers.
There you go. Now, if they could only date, you know, the Matt Reeves is the Batman close to my birthday, that'd be awesome. At some point before I'm like 95 years old, that would be even better. But I'll wait. As long as the quality is good, I'll wait. But with Wonder Woman 2 far off in the distance, before we get there, we got to talk about Wonder Woman, the first Wonder Woman. So let's do that.
Absolutely.
Why don't we start, as we always do, just general impressions, and then we'll get into specifics. So, Cammie, what did you think of general thoughts on Wonder Woman?
General thoughts on Wonder Woman. Okay, so you know when you go to a concert, and you see those people in the front row who are like really into it, like more than anybody else in the stadium. Mm-hmm. And you know how like at concerts, like where there's like bands playing, girls start throwing their bras on stage. Mm-hmm. I felt like that.
Okay, that's cool.
That was my response to seeing Wonder Woman. No, I'm kidding. But I mean, I'm only slightly kidding. It was just that, you know, you see somebody get really passionate about something, and we're all like passionate fans about different things, right? But this was one of those moments where you're watching the movie, and I think I mentioned this at Dragon Con, but I sort of felt like wondering, like, is this how guys feel when they watch a male superhero movie? Like, I feel like I could take on the world. Like, it was just this sense of, you know, it's what they want you to feel when you see a hero be a hero, right? You know, there's always a part in a hero movie where the hero saves the city or saves the town, whatever, right? And everybody's just sort of gazing in awe. And I kind of felt like that, like, it was my town that had just been saved. It was my universe that had just been saved. It was great. It was able to draw in, I think, even the most, not critical, but somebody who can easily stay removed from a story. I think they were able to structure in such a way that even if you feel removed from a story, you would still get drawn into this one.
Right. And to answer your question, yes, that is how guys feel most of the time when we go watch movies. At least I do. I know whenever I see a Batmobile chase, I want to go trample traffic with my car. But
yeah, absolutely.
Like that Batman Begins car chase, it was like, okay, all right, now I gotta get my, and worst thing still is when you play the soundtrack and that song comes on, you're in the car, it's like, wait, kind of just go on the rooftop and drive on the. But yeah, that's how we get when we see these movies. So it's nice that. No, that's not to say that women can't get that experience from watching every other superhero movie, but it's
sure.
There's no denying that it's a more, at least from what I got a sense from friends, from female friends of mine, it's a more deeper, intimate feeling when they're watching someone of their own gender do these things.
Yeah, there was just something about her approach to heroism that I think speaks to, you know, I don't want to say the female experience in some sort of pretentious way and pretend all female humans have the same experience, you know, but it just in the grand sense that women are socialized to respond to different situations differently and perhaps view heroism differently. There was just this perfect blend of, you know, this is a hero from a matriarchal society. You know, she's not just a woman. She was also raised by women, trained by women, all of that. And just to see that in her lineage and in the way she's interacting with people in the world. And yet she's not, you know, she's not portrayed as somebody who, you know, hates men, death to all men or anything like that. You know, she loves humankind, men, women, babies, everything. She just responds so positively to them. And there was something so it's not that I would say there's an aspect of relatability because she is a woman and, you know, as a woman watching it, there's something there you can relate to that you can't, or perhaps for some women you can, but I felt a little more removed, I guess, from some male heroes sometimes that mm-hmm. I felt closer to Wonder Woman's journey, but it's more than just relatability. It's more like the aspiration of it, I guess. It's not that you can relate to her, it's that you want to be like her, which is really fun. You know, just the same way when you see any kid, male, female, whatever, sort of looking up to heroes and wanting to be like them, it's kind of nice to still be able to feel that way as adults in the way that you would as a kid. And I felt that sort of little kids sort of look up to heroes and kind of want to be like them. And there's sort of that aspirational factor. It's not so much that they're relating to them. It's that they're wanting to relate to them, wanting to be like them. That's sort of how I felt, I think, watching Wonder Woman is there's this aspirational factor. You sort of want to be like her. And there's still that sort of childlike wonder seeing her do what she does.
Awesome. Jordan, what were your first or general impressions about Wonder Woman?
Yeah, well, I was really looking forward to this film, especially following BVS, because I loved what we saw of Gal Gadot's performance in that film, and, you know, to see her get her solo origin film, and I was just, I my expectations were met and frankly exceeded. I really was blown away by this movie. I was very pleased with it coming out of the theater for the first time. I thought it was an excellent origin story for the character. I thought that the cast did a phenomenal job. I really think they struck gold, particularly with Gal and Chris Pine's their chemistry with each other, because I think that is what I think the movie in a lot of ways. Are we talking spoilers now? Are we past the spoiler wall?
No. General thoughts, and then we're gonna go full spoiler.
Okay. All right. Well, I will control myself.
I mean, the movie's been out since whatever, but just for the sake of.
Yeah, I can skirt around it. I guess what I'll say is that I think the movie in a lot of ways does hinge on their you know, on you buying into their relationship in the film, and I think that it succeeds on that level. And I think one of the things that the film also that also stands out to me, and it's not just the leads in this film that stand out, it's that they get you invested in the supporting characters. So like Sammy and Charlie and Chief, I felt invested in all of them too. And so I think that when you can, in a movie, when you're invested not just in the leads, but in even the supporting characters, and Etta Candy too, she was one of the highlights of the film for me as well. She was just hilarious in the movie, and I think that when you buy into the supporting characters and you care about them, I think that is a testament in a lot of instances of a good film. And so yeah, just overall, I thought it was I do have a couple hangups about the movie. I thought that the villains, really all three of them, I thought could have been done a little bit better. But overall, I was just really, really impressed with this movie, and I loved it.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll just get to the point so then we can get to the meat of the issue. I love this film. I was so overwhelmed, and just like, here's the simple fact of it. I walked in excited, and I came out, and I had a big smile on my face. I haven't had that kind of a smile on my face for a superhero film probably since the end when I came out of Batman Begins for the first time. It just hit all the right notes. The most important thing is I felt that when I was the character of Wonder Woman was treated respectfully. They honored the history and the character that I read about in the comics, and I didn't find it that it it didn't go out of its way to say this is this is a female led superhero movie. It was just a superhero movie and treated with the same respect and seriousness that any other superhero movie would be treated. And I really appreciate Patty Jenkins for all those things, and obviously the cast and the rest of the crew. But overall, it's just an enjoyable, immersive experience from start to finish. That's my take on it, general take. So what do we think of how the film started with sort of the bookends from BVS with the picture, and how Bruce sends her a letter, or an email, I should say, a letter. Nobody sends. Well, no, wait a minute. It wasn't an email. It was a letter. So Bruce went old school with the letter there.
She went back with an email to him, but he sent her a letter.
Correct.
Right. I thought was kind of cool. You know, like he kind of meeting her where she's at.
Right. The present day scenario. I like that. But also, what I liked about this movie and what we can speak to is that, you know, it's part of the same universe. You know, the Man of Steel, Batman versus Superman, Suicide Squad universe, but it's very much its own separate entity. Like, you could watch this, and if you take out or didn't know any better about what the significance of Bruce Wayne's letter, you would just pick up this film like, okay, we're here, this is the world we're in, and let's get to it, right? It was not like if you didn't watch BBS, mm-hmm. you weren't scratching your head thinking, oh, I'm confused.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely made a point to make sure that this could stand on its own legs. And then there was something quite nice about, you know, you start the movie present day, and so you're kind of seeing where she ends up, mm-hmm. right? But it's starting present day, whereas, you know, the rest of the film is set, you know, back in time. And so it's not a spoiler to see her present day. You're seeing in the grand scheme of things, I suppose, where her journey ends up, but you're not seeing her, you know, standing with the ashes of Ares at her feet or anything like that. You know, it's not that much of a spoiler. It's just saying, you know, this young girl that you're about to see running around Themyscira, this is what she ends up as this seasoned heroine looking over humanity and preserving the history of the world, right? And so it's more of a metaphorical, you know, end up scene rather than a literal end of the battle scene cut to the beginning, as you could perhaps see in other movies.
Right. Jordan, what did you, by the way, what I thought about the other interesting thing about the letter opening is when she looks at the picture and you're instantly taken into the, you know, her childhood. I really got sucked in that moment. It felt like I was experiencing those memories with her, for me. And the way, just the way they transition, it all worked so beautifully. So I loved the whole aspect of that opening. To me was perfection. Jordan, what were your thoughts on the connective tissue with the letter and the picture, and then how it segues into into her past, but the contemporary time of the film or of the moments in the film.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So we are over the spoiler wall now. That's correct.
Yeah. Now you can spoil the whole thing. And if anybody has a problem with that, we're gonna give you Jordan's Twitter handle in a second. At the end of the podcast.
All right. Alrighty, well, I'm waiting for the hate mail to come. But so yeah, I love
it. Won't be from me, but that's besides the point. Continue.
I loved the framing device of you know, the present day and with the letter. It made me giddy to see the, you know, the Bruce Wayne reference. You know, the same thing happened to me in Suicide Squad. Every time in that movie we actually saw him, but you know, it had the same sort of effect on me here in Wonder Woman, seeing, you know, Wayne Enterprises on the truck, and then to see the letter. And I thought really it was very impactful at the end when in her email she wrote, "Thank you for bringing him back to me." I thought that was a really powerful. You know, it added a lot to it. Actually, retroactively added some even more emotional weight to Batman v Superman, because you see she's trying to track down that picture in Batman v Superman. You see how much it means to her, and you learn why that is in Wonder Woman. And so I thought that was a really emotional, thing for her, emotional response, you know, that she wrote back to him via email. And also the other thing I'll point out, you brought up Batman Begins a couple times in this episode, Adam, but the very end shot of this movie where she jumps off the rooftop, that reminded me so much of the end of Batman Begins.
Yeah, you're right.
So I don't know if that was intentional on Patty Jenkins' part or not, but I mean, we know she, we'll get into it later, but we know that she made a direct homage to Superman the movie, so I'm wondering if she did the same thing to Batman Begins, or if that was her intention with that, but that's certainly what it made me recall. But overall, you know, I really liked those that framing device. I thought that Diana, she had some, you know, monologue, I guess, or you heard her internal dialogue, I guess, yeah. What you'd call it. I don't know what you call that exactly, but a voiceover, I guess I'll say, during both.
That's the actual correct term for it, yes, voiceover.
Voiceover, there we go. Took me three tries, but I finally figured out, I found the word I was looking for.
You're thinking from a comic book standpoint, I understand where you're going.
But yeah, we heard that, and I actually really, that was one thing that always stands out to me about those framing devices, is hearing that, because I really like sort of what she's talking about there, so... I really thought that was a great framing device to sort of frame the rest of the movie as sort of a flashback. So I enjoyed it.
Right. And so then when we get into the, you know, so let's talk about the Themyscira and the sort of before she meets up with Steve. So the Diana through the years, let's call them. I don't know what the actual section of the movie is called. But I got to be honest with you, or Jordan probably knows this, Cammy doesn't know this unless she's heard our past episodes, and I'm not sure if I even mentioned it on past episodes. So even if you haven't been listening up until now, Cammy, I won't hold it against you.
I'm listening now, though.
If you haven't, I'll blame Jordan because of his terrible rant about Catwoman. But
oh my goodness.
I usually am very picky about child actors in these movies.
Yeah.
For instance, the kid in Superman Returns absolutely sucked. So I'm always leery when there's child actors. I'm like, oh, here we go. But this little girl that played young Diana, I swear to God, she just wormed her way into my heart instantly. It's like, I love this little kid. It's as if she was my niece. I'm like, I just want to give her a hug. She's adorable. And
she was so adorable.
Like, seeing her, like, imitate the other Amazonian women, I'm like, man, I wanted to start imitating them because they were so badass. But... like, I instantly connected with this little, like, well, the thing is, when the shot pans over and you're seeing what the Amazons are doing from her perspective,
mm-hmm.
you really feel like her being awestruck and in a state of wonder over them, you know what I mean?
Pun right.
Not intended, but you really get that sensation. And then following her and you know, when she's trying to sort of bargain with her mother, where she's like, you know, she wants to train, and the mother's like, no, and then she's like, but you know, I want to do the sword fighting, and the mother again, no, and then she's trying to bargain. She's like, okay, nothing with sharp edges or whatever line of dialogue it is. I'm like, man, this kid, it's a way of when the young actress is so good. As she was, and so down her performance, it felt honest, almost like she wasn't acting.
Right.
So to me, it just
immerses you into that moment. It makes you instantly believe.
Yeah, I'm like, this is young Wonder Woman, and I'm 100%. I'm like, I'm in. I'm you've mm-hmm. whatever else you're going to do, I'm going to buy it. And there was part of me that wanted to spend, like, I'm like, okay, I know this is a movie and I know we got to get to, like, fully grown Wonder Woman. But, man, I could spend another half an hour to 45 minutes just watching this little girl try and want to learn and be a full-fledged Amazon and get up into, like, you know, precarious, get herself in trouble and stuff. Like, I could have watched another half an hour to 40 minutes of that.
Right.
And then, you know, as it transitions, I like the fact that it sort of did a I like the fact that it did a montage of her training and her through the years and getting older, because there was that part of me that's like, okay, let's get to like fully grown Diana now. I want to get, like, to move the story along for the sake of moving the story along. I wanted to get, you know, to get to it. It was, and again, it was kind of like the way, you know, Batman Begins was kind of all over the place in terms of timeline. It went back and forth. But this, in the way it moved from the different scenes of his, you know, training and youth and all that, like leading up to that, this had the same pace. It was just organized differently, but the pacing was on par. And I really liked that aspect of it. I thought it worked very well for the film. Although, again, you want to give me a full movie of about the Amazons, I'll sign up for that right away. The scenes that really got me, and we can all discuss this, and you can all go back and talk about what I just spoke about if you want. But the beachfront battle when Steve Trevor arrives, and then the German soldiers follow shortly thereafter. That battle has got to be, for me, one of the best fight/action scenes I've ever seen. Like, I was totally transfixed on it. It reminded me, it was like the love child of Gladiator and 300. And to me, it superseded both, because there's just something about, and again, it's partly to do with finally, you know, women are being put in the position of being at the forefront of this kind of movie.
Right.
But seeing those badass tough women just charging down the beach and you know, being the, cause you were used to in superhero movies, with the exception of Black Widow and, you know, Catwoman and such, and in some instances, Lois Lane, nine times out of 10, you're going to see the woman as being the damsel in distress, the girlfriend, you know what I'm saying? So it was such a change of pace, and it was so, wow, that's the word I'm looking for. So unique, I've never seen that in any movie, and it just, the way it was shot with the slow mo, and the choreography of it all, and the music, the soundtrack was, composer, Jordan?
Rupert Gregson-Williams.
His score in these scenes was fantastic. Like, it was just phenomenal. And all that between the uniqueness of seeing all these women charge on the beach into battle and the slow-mo, like, all of that, plus the music. It just, again, to me, it's one of the best, I think one of the best fight sequences committed to film. So I'm like, even now when I have the Blu-ray, I'll go back, put it in, and just rewatch that sequence over and over. I've got no problems with that. I loved it, and it's one of my, as of right now, it's one of the best scenes in the DC Connected Universe. What did you guys think of it? Let's give Jordan a chance, and then we'll go back to you, Cammy. Jordan,
the mic is all yours.
Yeah, what was your thought of it?
I love this stuff too. I thought that you brought up, there were actually two young Dianas before we got to Gal, but the little one
was so much, like, she just stole the show.
The first one, yeah, she really stood out to me. There were two moments in particular. One was when she said, when Hippolyta caught her when she tried to jump off the ledge, and she goes, "How are you today, mother?" That cracked me up. And then And then the other one was when Hippolyta shows her the God Killer sword, which we later find out is not actually the God Killer sword, but the sword. She does the same exact smirk that we saw Gal Gadot do in Batman v Superman. She does the exact same smirk when she sees the God Killer sword, and Hippolyta tells her like, you can't wield it. Only the strongest among us can, or whatever. And she does that same smirk that we saw from Wonder Woman. We've also seen in the Justice League marketing that Wonder Woman does again. So I thought it was really cool how sort of she did that too here. You brought up the battle on the beach at Themyscira. That, I mean, yeah, I agree with you 100%. That was just it was phenomenal, and I think that it really one really poignant part of that is when one of the Amazons gets shot, and we saw this in the trailer, and I had a feeling that this was going to go, but it's like the first time Diana sees what sort of a gun can do, and she sees I thought that was really powerful. And then of course when Antiope dies, I mean, I just thought that was a really that whole scene was just, I mean, it was awesome from an action standpoint, but in terms of just how powerful that scene was in many respects, that also impressed me a lot. And of course, right before that scene, we got our first introduction of Steve Trevor, and I feel like he really he really had a great presence, and really right from the start, you could see how well he and Diana were going to click in this movie, because it's that hilarious line where she's like, you're a man, and he's like, what, do I not look like one? And that just right from the start, that cracked me up. So yeah, all that stuff on Themyscira, I'm with you, Adam. I could have watched a whole movie of the Amazons on Themyscira.
And you know a movie is going to be good when, like, these superhero movies are killing me, because I find myself, you know, on the verge of tears in quite a bit of them, and it's like there's only so long that I can excuse it to allergies. you know, so but when Antiope gets shot, and then you have, you know, Diana goes over, and that whole, I'm like, okay, here we go with the music, here come the, you know, I was getting emotional, and I'm like, I just got introduced to these people, to this group of women, especially, you know, Antiope and her mother and Diana as a fully formed adult, and yet I'm already so emotionally invested, and it took virtually no time at all, and I'm like, okay, they have something with this movie. I'm not just getting swept away by the cool action scene. It's so much more to it, and that moment really sort of clicked that in for me. Cammy, what did you think of the whole early Themyscira beachfront war the battle sequence? What were your impressions of that?
I think it sort of set the stage for us as viewers to sort of see these women and see these heroes through the eyes of a child. It's sort of setting the stage for that childlike wonder, you know, and that's exactly what you want in a superhero movie, right? Is to be able to sort of suspend disbelief and just get immersed in the story and be willing to believe in their, you know, superpowers and magic and all of that. And by having a child, like you said, play Diana, who's so believably enamored with what these women can do, and it's, you know, she's wanting to be like them when she grows up, and it's sort of, you know, we all can sort of relate to that feeling of, you know, watching heroes and heroines do these fantastic things in movies and wanting to be just like them when we grow up too. So that, I think, set the stage for the rest of the movie, and it was fun, you know, just like how the tone of the opening sequence where we see older Diana set the stage for what we knew she was going to become, which is, you know, hopeful but grounded in a much different way. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I think just seeing baby Diana kind of allowed us to immediately get immersed in her journey, which was a lot of fun.
Awesome. And the other thing I commend with this movie is that it really, you know, we keep referencing Batman Begins, but a lot of it is, You sense that three act structure, like, you know how in Superman 78 there was Krypton, there was Smallville, then there was Metropolis. This had that same vibe to it with, you know, the Themyscira. Then you move on to, you know, she meets Steve Trevor and they head off for London, and then you get into the where basically she goes to the war front and all that, and then the third act kicks in. It was very much, it reminded me a lot of Superman 78 in the way it was structured as well. which was I thought it's a smart way to go. When you're dealing with the origin and given the situation that the DC films were in terms of their critical reception, they needed something that was familiar and like at least in terms of set up an organization, a more straightforward approach to the storytelling, and so I thought that worked really well. One of the things I loved, and Jordan touched on it briefly, another great aspect of this film was the interactions between Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman and Diana, and Chris Pine as Steve Trevor. I mean, their chemistry was incredible, wonderfully believable. One of the things I liked about it was that it brought a lot of humor to the film, but it was never forced humor. And not to make this a Marvel versus DC thing, but that's the problem I have with a lot of the MCU films, is the humor is in some cases quite often forced. See Thor 2 and the whole Jane Foster and Kat Dennings, whatever character's name is. That film is terrible. But you know, that's an example of humor that I don't like. Here, it was so naturalistic and just a part of their, general interactions. And I love the fact that, there was, I don't know if objectification is the right word, but it was flipped because, when the man sees the woman, he's all gaga over her, or he's looking at her. Not that Wonder Woman was all gaga over Steve, but when you see him and he's in the Amazon, the bath area, whatever it is. And he's the one half naked or mostly naked and being objectified is the wrong word. I can't think of the proper word, but like where the audience is like all the jokes and the sexual innuendo is happening, but it's where usually you get that in a film where it's directed towards the woman. It was inversed, like it was towards the man. And I really thought, I'm like, all right, they're doing it, but they're doing it in a way where it's never like, whether it's from the male perspective or the female perspective, you can do it and it's smart and it comes off as funny. Or there's films that do it and it comes off as just, okay, now you're just going for the voyeuristic, kind of Michael Bay style, shot. But I thought it was done very cleverly with the watch, and I thought the humor in those scenes worked. And even later on when they're on the boat and he's like, she's so innocently saying, don't you sleep? Aren't you going to like come lie down beside me or come sleep next to me? And he's apprehensive about it because of the context of sleeping. You know what I mean? That whole interaction I thought was very well handled. It could have been, taken the wrong way. But I thought Patty Jenkins dealt with it so well. And again, just to me, the fact that it was inverted for once was a nice change of pace. I mean, you still get the man's point of view, like when in later scenes when she's with the team, and Steve is like, she was on an island, and then I can't remember who said it. One of them said, "There's an island full of women like her. Take me to So there is.
It was Sammy.
Right. There is still a bit of that, but it's never like I'm so happy with the way it was portrayed on both sides. I thought it was, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
I thought, but those initial scenes with Gal and Steve in that scenario were quite good. And it also just points to those scenes to me really highlighted Diana's sort of honesty and innocence in that she's not, I mean, the audience is getting a chuckle because of the whole watch thing and certain lines that she says that have innuendo behind them. But in that moment, Diana is genuinely asking out of unknowing, like a general naivete, you let yourself be run by that little thing. She's being the watch. Everybody in the audience is thinking something else. But it's just from the character's point of view, it's so, you know, genuine. It's a genuine, like I said, honesty and naivete that I and it carried through the whole film. When she sees, you know, when they go over to London and she sees ice cream for the first time or a baby for the first time, there's just this general honesty that comes from Gal Gadot's performance, where it's never, again, I felt the same way that I did with a kid, where I got lost in it to the point where that wasn't Gal Gadot acting. That was just Diana being honest, naive, and new to the world. And
I think it sets the stage as well to sort of clue the audience in on a deeper level of the fact that time is different for her. And she's not on the same plane of time for us, right. Which is, you know, that's I think a hard concept for, you know, us to understand. So it's not just, you know, a matter of simply being like immortal or not immortal, but, you know, the way time controls Steve is just different than the way it controls her, whether he had a watch or not. So it's just a nice way to nod to that rather than getting too literal, I suppose.
Right. And then the other thing, what did you think? The other thing I liked and I want to get your thoughts on, I love the fact that, yes, she had a naivete and an honesty, but she also already from the get-go had a core sort of belief system that she wasn't going to back down from, even when her mother said no, or when she was determined to go help humanity.
Yeah, and it was nice to see her butting heads with her mother and, you know, the others who were leaders within that group, because we sort of get a cue to what her personality is even before she begins butting heads with humans, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it lets us know that this is a pre-existing characteristic of her that didn't just develop when she, you know, had to deal with infuriating humans, right? So that was nice to see, and it sets the tone for her personality outside of just how she reacts to, you know, the men she's trying to defeat or the men she's trying to work with. And it was important to see just enough of her backstory without this becoming too backstory heavy of a movie. You know, we needed a full plot, but it was enough to where we could see a pre-existing personality in her, both as a child and as an adult. And we could see that she had a moral code of her own, and she wasn't just carrying out the moral code of her group. So there was this balance where she would often talk about the morals of, you know, those on Themyscira and what she was taught and a lot of what she believed. But then we also see that there's morals and values and sort of heroic ideals that are specific to her and specific to her, you know, cause and what she wants to do with her time as a, you know, hero or advocate or however she sees herself in the beginning of the movie. And that's important to set up. The general and the specific when it comes to her background.
Jordan, what were your thoughts on that aspect of it with the, you know, the way the end, the confrontation with her mother as they said goodbye? And also, I mean, you touched on the whole Steve-Diana dynamic a little bit, but any more do you want to add specifically to the...
Sure. I guess I'll start with the Steve and Diana dynamic. You referenced basically the two. I mean, along with the Etta Candy stuff, I thought that those two scenes with Diana and Steve Trevor were pretty much the funniest moments in this film. The scene, and I guess what did you call it, Adam? I guess just the bath. Is that what you called it?
Yeah, the Amazonian bath. I'm not sure what it is. I mean, it looked like one of those. It reminded me of those ancient Roman or Greek, you know, those communal baths they kind of had, but sort of. I mean, I was going to call it a sauna, but it's not really a sauna. But yeah, I guess we call it the bath.
Yeah, the bath. Yeah, that scene was really, really funny. And the also the scene on the boat. I thought that, I mean, it just the part of that where she's like, she brings out the books and he asks her if she brought them with her, and she tells him he wouldn't enjoy them. I you know, that just that had me laughing so hard in the theater. I really, it did. I guess I will talk a little bit about you. You brought up the end confrontation with Hippolyta, so I'll get to a scene that's not as funny. But that scene was I thought that was really powerful as well, because it was sort of like Diana's sort of mission statement almost. Like, she couldn't live with herself if she didn't try and go stop Ares and help the war. Like, she's like, who would I be if I stay? Like, she really couldn't live with herself if she hadn't gone and try to do the right thing. So I thought that was great. And one thing I wanted to touch on that I forgot to earlier, because you brought it up, Adam, was Rupert Gregson-Williams' score in this film. Just before I forget, I just want to bring it up, because overall in this movie, that score is just phenomenal. Now, yeah. Now, Adam, when we recorded our Batman v Superman episode, I mentioned that I was not nearly as big a fan of that Wonder Woman riff that Hans Zimmer did.
It's most... one of your more crazy ideas that you didn't need, but go on.
It didn't quite work for me, but I think that Rupert Gregson-Williams, he used it in this movie, but he used it sparingly. But what he did instead was he really did craft a just a really beautiful score around that. I think that there's sort of another Wonder Woman theme in this movie, and it plays during the No Man's Land scene, and it's what we use as part of our intro music for this podcast. And that's what it's that little maybe 30 seconds maybe that always gets me super hyped whenever I'm listening to the score and that part comes on, because yeah, that's why we included it in our intro music. But it's so good, and I just really thought that Rupert Gregson-Williams just did a pretty remarkable job with the score for this film.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The score was fantastic. So when we get to, you know, they arrive was it London, right? And so basically now we're getting into the crux of what they have to deal with, and that is that, you know, General Ludendorff and what was the girl's name?
Dr. Poison.
Yeah. They're creating the mustard gas, right?
So yeah.
So Steve basically has infiltrated them as a spy, and has found the formulas and all that, and he wants to sort of take action against them. And you know, there's the one, before I get to General Ludendorff and Dr. Poison, there's the one moment it's not a courthouse, it's like a meeting room where the generals are all meeting. And they're discussing what the plan of attack is going to be, and then basically they tell Steve, no, you don't have authorization to go in. And you know, Diana sneaks in, and they're all like, what is a woman doing in here? Because back in those days, you know, women weren't part of these discussions. And then so you know, Steve is basically pleading with, if we don't do anything, So many soldiers, so many people are going to die. And then one of the generals is like, well, for lack of a better word, he says something to the effect of, in modern times, it would be, that's the job. They knew what they were getting, you know, they knew what they were signing up for. And then Diana comes in and basically reads him the riot act, saying, what kind of general are you, on my world, generals fight alongside the other soldiers. And just that, again, it's that like,
you should be ashamed.
Yeah. But it's that pure honesty. It's that pure honesty from Gal and her performance. And I guess, you know, what was in the script, but it has to come from the performance, because the words on paper are one thing, and it's the performer. And her, it's just, it's like, I was like, damn right, you tell them how it is. You know what I mean? And it's like, you can't help but get. Like, at one moment, you're horrified because the guy is willing to let a bunch of people die. But then in the next moment, in the same moment, you're like, go get him, Diana. You know what I mean? It's giving you these conflicting emotions. And it really, it's just powerful acting done by Gal Gadot. It's phenomenal. And then the other thing I want to mention, because I didn't mention it in the mascara portion, because shortly after that scene, you see Steve Trevor... He's like, because then he takes Diana out of the room, and Diana thinks that he's going to agree with his superiors. And she's like, how could you lie to me? Blah, 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 blah. She's reading him the riot act. And then he's like, I'm not lying. And he puts the lasso around his wrist, and he starts telling her the actual plan, that they're going to go against what the general advised, and he's going to they're going to form the small team and go in there right. themselves. The way that the lasso was used in the Themyscira scenes, and also here, the whole idea of, you can't tell a lie. I thought that was done very, very effectively, because when you see it in animation or like the 70s Wonder Woman show, you're like, right. well, this could come off very cheesy if it's not, like, how's it going to work? But again, I thought it was handled superbly. I mean, I don't think there's anything that Patty Jenkins can't make work in, even the most fantastical. Like, I would love to see what she does with the invisible jet. I don't know if we're ever going to get it. But if anybody can make that believable, it's probably Patty Jenkins.
It was in this film, Adam. We just couldn't see it.
I knew you were gonna make that joke.
Oh my god! Ever, you know how many times I've heard that joke about this movie?
I think I've been hearing this joke way back in the press for BBS. But let's talk about a little bit as we get further in the quote unquote villains of this movie. First of all, the specifically these two. In General Ludendorff and Dr. Poison. I thought that for me, apparently I read that General Ludendorff was actually a real guy.
Yeah, that's true.
And again, the fact that they're using they used a real general from that period just grounded things a little bit more, made it more believable. Like, it further puts you into this world. I thought Dr. Poison was a little bit weak overall. She was probably the weakest link of the film for me. But I got to give Patty Jenkins
I really like Dr. Poison.
Really? I don't know if I didn't dislike it. It's just I don't think she had enough to do. Maybe that was
I was
it.
So happy when they didn't kill her, I guess, because I kind of agree with you about her not having enough to do because she was having to work for somebody else. Right. But when they didn't kill her, it gave me sort of hope that they may touch on her again.
I'll give you that. I'm glad they didn't kill her, because I think, and you know what was a little bit jarring? For a film that spends all this time showing you all these awesome, independent, strong women, right? And the film is littered with them. You have this one that is basically working for, General Ludendorff, and that's but I got to give credit to everybody involved in that. I totally, bought the line that they were trying to sell me, that Ludendorff was somehow Ares. For right up until the moment where he's not, I thought, all right, that's Ares, and it's partly because. I got to give credit to Danny Houston, I think is the actor, mm-hmm. who was also in the terrible X-Men Origins Wolverine film. Mm-hmm. But let's not go there. Let's forget about that. his performance was convincing. I'm like, that's Ares. I mean, at times it was, there were certain moments where it was a little over the top, but it never veered too far over.
It did, Adam. I gotta fight you on that. The scene where they throw the stuff into the meeting room and he's like, Dr. Poison's like, the mask won't do anything, and he's like, but they don't know that, and they both start cackling. That took me out of the movie.
I mean, it was on the razor's edge, but it wasn't enough to take me out of the movie. Personally, but I that's fair. But point being is that the whole time, my main crux of the thing is because of, let's say 3/4 of his performance, I totally bought that he was Ares. And the other thing that I got to give him credit for is that when Ares does reveal himself, it's like it's the most unsuspecting person you'd think of. Again, I find that a lot of these movies nowadays try and force a twist on you. It's like, let's do the Ra's al Ghul twist. I mean, Iron Man 3 tried it and failed miserably. But it worked. Like, it had me hook, line, and sinker the whole time. So I was totally on board with these with the twist. And like I said, I had problems with Dr. Poison more so than I did your thing with Ludendorff, but I had problems with her. But again, I don't think it was anything to do with the actress. I think it was just the way the character was written. What are your guys' takes on let's say, those two characters, first and foremost, and then we'll get to Ares a little bit later. But what is your take on that? Let's start with you, Cammy.
Sure. So, well, with Dr. Poison, I think I was just, you know, we love seeing a female hero, but I also love seeing a female villain. So I was excited about that. And then I just thought that the way they portrayed her was really interesting throughout, where she had perhaps different motivations than Ludendorff, but was equally committed to the cause. And whereas he kind of wanted this sort of evil power, whatever, for himself, you know, we see him taking, you know, supplements is not the right term, but, you know, evil villain.
Evil supplements.
Evil supplements, steroids, whatever it is. Yeah, all right, we see him taking what?
The 1918 equivalent of superpowered steroids. There we go.
Absolutely. So we see him taking that himself, you know, and he wants that power for himself. And Dr. Poison wants power, but she doesn't, she wants power to use on others, and she wants, you know, power to affect others, but she doesn't need to make herself be some sort of big, strong monster herself. So I thought that was just interesting to differentiate between the two villains. They weren't just two villains so that the villains could talk to each other. There were two villains because the two villains had different motivations. So I thought that was pretty cool.
And I will say the one thing I did like about Dr. Poison and the performance the actress gave, and her name is escaping me, but there's this
Elena Anaya.
Oh, there you go. Thank you. And I might as well check with you now, just so we can get this out of the way, Jordan. She wasn't on Smallville, was she?
I don't believe so. Okay, you were the one who surprised me. You were the one who surprised me with that guy, Anson Mount. Is that what that guy's name is?
Yes.
You were the one who surprised me with that. So.
Okay, we covered the obligatory Smallville reference. We're good.
Maybe it was Zachy. Maybe it was Zachy. I don't remember. But
we can move on now. I've covered the obligatory Smallville reference for you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Adam.
We're moving on. So one thing I liked about her performance was when she and Steve Trevor were having a conversation later on in the film when he's at that quote unquote celebration party, even though they're about to lose. And he's talking to her and he's showing her all kinds of, you know, interest, and she's finally feeling important is maybe not the right word, but she, for lack of a better thing that comes to mind, I'll say important. And then Diana walks in the room and he sort of looks over at her, because he's like, what the hell, you know, why, what is she doing here? I told her not to, but she, you know, Dr. Poison doesn't know that. And then when she sees him look at Diana, all of a sudden she's feeling that sense of, what is the word? Help me out here. She's feeling almost like left out or passed over, you know, and it's like, it's something that keeps happening to her. And I really felt that the actress did a good job of, with very few little words, conveying that emotion of, oh, you've moved on to the prettiest girl in the room kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it was very well, the acting in that scene was very strong. From her point
of view. But she was never fully under his charms. You know, she never gave him what he wanted. So it was nice to see her still be strong like that. I mean, yes. I know we're not supposed to root for a villain, but it's nice to see her not just, you know, fall for some guy's charms, I guess.
Yes, exactly. So I like that aspect of it. The other thing that I, you know, before we get obviously to the Ares portion, let's talk about, you know, you mentioned it earlier, Jordan. You brought up Diana and the formation of her team that's also involved in this picture, this famous picture that's at the crux of the beginning of the movie. The team,
Hold up! I got some more complaints about the villains.
But as long as it's not Ares, because we're not there yet. But go ahead.
No. About Ludendorff and Dr. Poison, because they were the weakest link of this movie for me.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So basically, I brought it up a little bit before, but they just for me, Dr. Poison at times she was super creepy. It's sort of the Enchantress problem from Suicide Squad. At times she was super creepy, and then at other times she was like completely over the top. Like, there's, I brought up the one scene where they throw the gas in the into the room and they start cackling, and there's yeah. there's another scene too where Dr. Poison has this line where she like she turns right to the camera and she's like, "It's going to be terrible," and then the it switches to another scene, and it's like it felt like she was in a completely different movie in some of those scenes. And with Ludendorff wasn't as bad in terms of that. Like he at least I felt like was in the same movie as the rest of this film. But with Ludendorff, my issue was here's the thing. They never addressed anything about that gas he was inhaling. There's all these fan theories that it might be some kind of precursor to Venom. I don't really subscribe to that notion. I think it's kind of interesting. But I don't really subscribe to that as a particularly plausible idea. It's like they didn't. You think they would have addressed, you know, what the hell that was at some point in the movie, and it's just they sort of just left it hanging and never addressed. Like it's like I understand what they were trying to do. They were trying to set him up as a red herring, as Ares, but it's like it's just this normal guy who's taking this substance. Like I felt like there should have been some sort of explanation of what he was actually doing, because they lead you to believe that what he's doing is like he's Ares and he's trying to replenish his health. But like, if that's not the case, which they told us it wasn't, like I felt like they dropped the ball on us, or they dropped the ball on it for us as an audience by not addressing that. So for me, those were the two were definitely the I would say the weakest parts of this movie for me.
Yeah, I mean I can't argue with that. I'll give you that for sure. But. Yeah, I'll give you that. That's fine. I won't argue that.
I mean, he's the human villain.
Right.
But what is he taking? Well, I mean, if he's just a human though, what is he doing?
I mean, he has to. So that's just to. I mean, you mentioned it's sort of a fake out for Ares, right? But he's a human villain, and so he's what Diana believes doesn't exist, right? So he's kind of necessary in that sense, or else she won't ever understand humanity. But in it's sort of the reverse of her, in that, you know, she's, you know, a demigoddess, whatever, but she's dabbling among humans, right? He's a human, but through the substances he's taking, there's just sort of trying to insinuate that he's trying to be a god, right? He wants to be a god. He wants to have that power. So they're the opposite of each other way.
And remember, I think it was Ares in his monologue afterwards. He says that he was feeding them the information. So he whatever that concoction was, he was the one sort of whispering the formulas into her head so she can concoct these potions for him. So it's got to be something rooted in that. So I mean, I didn't quite. I'm like, all right, some temporary enhanced power concoction that Ares sort of fed to them. But that's what I thought. I didn't give it too much thought after Ares was revealed to be Ares. It was like, all right.
I like that perspective. I like that perspective. That actually puts a little bit of a new perspective on it, particularly what you said, Cammy. I wish they would have addressed it. I wish that once they did the Ares reveal, I wish they would have gone, okay, the person you thought was Ares, what he was actually doing was he was, you know, I wish they would have just, even if it was just a throwaway line, I wish they would have just addressed the fact that he was, you know, he had set him up as a red herring, and that what he was actually doing, what you were seeing him actually do, was so and so.
Yeah, but I don't think they have to tell you that he was a red herring. I mean, you saw it.
Yes, we know he's a red herring. But what I'm saying is, I wish they would have addressed like what, you know, said, okay, he's taking a substance because of because Dr. Poison had a line that was like, it's replenishing. I've made you something to replenish your strength, and it's like, so what happened? Why did he lose his strength? Why does he need something to replenish his strength? Like there's no backstory there. We're just
I mean, his strength needs to be replenished because he's old. Again, another aspect where he's different from Diana, right? Because again, she exists on a different time plane, right?
Yeah.
And he doesn't. He's on the human timetable, and he's aging as a human, but he wants to be a god, essentially. So replenishing his strength is just his attempt at sort of immortality, godlikeness, becoming like her, I guess.
Okay. All right.
I like her explanation. I'm going with it. I defer. She wins the argument. No.
Can I get one. On? I get one win.
That's the only real thing you brought up to her. But if you ever bring up anything again, she'll probably beat you there too. I want to have her on the Catwoman podcast just so I could just sit back and watch her tear your arguments to shreds. I think I'm going to set that up.
I thought you canceled our Catwoman podcast.
Yeah, but if it's just you and her arguing over it and I just get to sit and referee, I'll sit here for that. I just don't physically want to talk about the actual specifics of that movie. Is that all you had to say about those two, Jordan?
Yeah, you're good, Adam. You're good.
Okay, so before we get to Aries, I want to make mention of the team dynamic because it leads into one of my favorite sequences ever put to superhero filmmaking. But what you mentioned earlier, Jordan, the Chief and Sammy and all the ragtag group that Steve Trevor assembles. One of the things that really was special about it for me was that the way Diana cares for them, and it's almost like, and it was cool because you have this strong, tough, you know, Amazonian independent woman, superheroic woman, and then you also get the sort of, like, she was very nurturing to because all of them had, you know, the one which was the one with the PTSD, the Irish dude,
Charlie.
The way she nurtured them all, like almost like a maternally kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, those little scenes between her and the team, and the way she sort of listened to all their problems, and sort of tried to just talk them through it and made them feel important and valuable, to me was so emotionally powerful, and it really gave this maternal nurturing aspect to Diana, which is different throughout the rest of the film because you're seeing Diana as new to the world, naive, almost like a childlike innocence, right? But then she switches gears and she's having this maternal relationship with these guys who are struggling with different issues, different problems, and I thought that was a great bit of you know, moments, a selection of moments in the film.
The line that always warms my heart is when she tells Charlie, "But who will sing for us?" when he's about to leave.
And even the one where Simon's like, I wanted to be an actor, right? But because of the color of my skin, they say I can't be, or something to that effect. And then she's like, you can be anything you want to be, or something in line with that. To me, just those moments, it's like this movie really hits every single note, every single beat of Wonder Woman's character, and it highlights every single one of them of the Wonder Woman that I'm familiar with from the comics. And I just, even those quieter scenes, those, like I said, those more nurturing scenes, I love those just as much as the ass-kicking, badass Wonder Woman scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just so emotionally charged. So let's just, what were your guys' overall takeaway from the her dynamic with her team?
Jordan, I'll let you take this one first.
Oh, okay. I was waiting for you to start and then, but okay. I will go ahead. I loved, like I said, sort of in my general thoughts, I think I really loved how much we didn't have that much time with these characters, but even as supporting characters, how much we came to care about them, or at least I did, over the course of this movie. Like, it really is a testament to how good a job that they did with these characters. Like, I mentioned, like, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is the scene where Diana says that to Charlie, where he's about to leave, and she says, "Who will sing for us?" And then the scene with Samir that you brought up, Adam, I loved as well. And then there's a scene with Chief where he tells Diana who took the land from his people, and he says his people. You know, you really get to see why all these characters are there and what makes all these characters special, sort of. And I think that, you get moments with them, like when, I mean, before the scene where she tells Charlie who will sing for us, you get the scene where he's actually singing. And, I mean, you see these different sides of this character, and they sprinkle it in there so that you really, by the end of the movie, you're really invested in these characters. And Sammy, of course, brought a lot of the humor to this film. He really cracked me up. You know, when we first meet him and he goes back and forth with Wonder Woman and all the different languages, that cracked me up.
Oh, that was great.
And then the line, and then when the guy draws a gun, and then she like kicks him across the room, and then Sammy has the line where he's like, "I'm both frightened and aroused," and that line cracked me up too. So he sort of was the humorous one of the group, and I thought I'm not really counting Etta Candy as part of this group because she wasn't really with them for most of the movie.
We talked about it because we haven't mentioned her either. So you go ahead and bring her up.
Okay. All right. Well, cool. Well, then I will talk about her as well right now. But what I was going to say is in terms of that group, those three, Sammy was sort of the humorous one. But yeah, if we're including Etta Candy too, I guess because we did sort of, I feel like we skipped over sort of the part where she was most in the movie.
Yeah, you can talk about that too. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah. When Diana first comes to London and Etta Candy Lucy Davis did such a good job here because like even when she just has so many, I guess, she's just so quirky, and she has so many, what I noticed, particularly on this most recent rewatch of the movie that I did in preparation for this podcast, is she, half the time, she's not even saying words. She's just making these sound effects, like, boop, 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 like, she's, like, she has all these, like, quirky, like, you know, she's not even saying anything. She's just, when Diana does something, I found her really, she's just really humorous in this film, and she has a lot of great lines, like the line about, she a lot of great interactions with Diana, I guess I should say. She has the first line when she's like, she tells Diana what she does as a secretary, and Diana's like, where I come from, that's called slavery, and it's because like they have such different life experiences, and to sort of see the contrast there was, in that instance it was pretty humorous. And then there's a scene that also really cracks me up where she's trying to find Diana some clothes, and she has the line where Diana puts on the glasses and she's like, and suddenly she's not the most beautiful woman you've ever seen. And that cracked me up. And then also when Diana hands her the sword and the shield, and she's like, she can barely carry it.
And she's like, protect it with your life.
Yes. and it's like, no. And she's like that was really funny too. So all those scenes, that was just, it really was that whole sequence when Diana was in London, just a lot of humorous moments in there. So Etta was great.
And the cool thing about those, sorry to interrupt, Cammy, before you get
no, you're fine
going. But the cool thing about the sort of Wonder Woman in London scenes was that's where we got our Superman the movie nods, that, you know, Patty Jenkins says she was a huge fan of the Richard Donner Superman film growing up. And you get three real nods. First of all, the glasses bit was a nod to the Clark Kent persona, the way Christopher Reeve did it. And when she tries to go through the revolving door with the sword and she gets stuck, is very similar to the scene between Lois and Clark in the Daily Planet at the beginning near the beginning of Superman the movie. And then, of course, the alleyway where she blocks the bullet, where she catches the bullet with her hand as one of the German spies fires on Steve. That was like almost, verbatim of Christopher Reeve's Clark stopping the bullet from hitting Lois in the alleyway. So those.
Did you notice, Adam, because I only noticed it on this most recent rewatch of the movie, so I was curious if anybody else picked up on this. The guy who... it is trying to go through the door right before, and Steve lets him go through before he lets Diana go through.
He was in Smallville.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't in Smallville. Unless he wasn't, I didn't realize. Of course, you think that's where I'm going to go with this. No, he was the same guy who went and attacked them later in the alleyway, and I totally didn't pick up on this until the most recent watch through of this movie is that, The guy is the same guy.
I just rewatched it. I didn't pick up on that, but now it gives me a reason to watch it again. I think I'll have to do that. I needed my arm pulled. But sorry to interrupt. Can I go ahead? What were your thoughts on the Wonder Woman and her band of brothers? Let's call them.
My comment was mostly about Etta Candy. It's just I just think that she continued that theme of people reacting to this concept of a heroine with that childlike wonder. Mm-hmm. Etta Candy's not a child, and Wonder Woman's not a child at that point either, but she just has this she immediately believes in her. And she doesn't understand her necessarily or understand what's going on, but it sort of cues the audience into believing in Diana's mission as well, even if we don't necessarily know how the movie's going to end at that point, right? And I liked that theme continued as just sort of, you know, being in awe and being able to sort of enjoy what's going on and enjoy the hero's journey that we're seeing through how her team reacts to her. And it's just a really good example of that. But, you know, we see the same in the guys. We see the same in Charlie. Jordan referenced one of the lines that I like, the whole who will sing for us bit. That's just so characteristic of Diana's response to people, is that she doesn't just value them for their ability to, you know, to fight or to kill somebody or whatever, which I think was really cool. And it's a necessary bit to her character. So I don't know. I like the team that they put together for her. Awesome. I think there was a lot of thought that went into that.
Nice. And it's funny because I mentioned how she had a mothering relationship mm-hmm. with those members of the team. I can already see in trailers for Justice League that she could have a similar relationship with characters like The Flash and Cyborg. And I think that would be really cool to see that play out, you know, what is it, 100 years later? So I hope they carry that forward. But, you know, that interaction with the team eventually leads us to them trying to cross No Man's Land. And I gave it away beforehand, but screw it, I'll say it again. That whole scene, to me, and then the battle that happened afterwards, so it's the No Man's Land sequence, the Themyscira, the beach battle, mm-hmm. and the BVS warehouse Batman Martha rescue are, to me, the top three scenes of this connected DC Films franchise so far. And this No Man's Land scene, it gave me the scene, and my go-to character first and foremost is Batman. I'll say that right now. But that No Man's Land scene gave me the same chills and goosebumps as the warehouse Batman fight did. It was phenomenal. And leading up to it, like, Diana's reaction to all the people that were suffering and the look of sadness and just frustration in her face, like, why aren't we doing anything about this? Why aren't we helping people? And then Steve is trying to explain to her that we can't save everybody. And she's like, you know, maybe you can't, but that's what I'm here to do. And then she has the whole, you know, where she gets into full Wonder Woman mode, and she slow-mo walks across No Man's Land, mm-hmm. and deflecting the bullets, the whole thing, again, leading up to the music, how anybody, man or woman, if you didn't have goosebumps and weren't pumped up during that scene, then I question whether you're human or not, because that's how incredible it was for me. Cammy, what were the reactions, the emotions that you were feeling in those moments?
I think there's this ongoing sense of anticipation throughout the movie, and that just sort of stays throughout. It's just okay. What moment in particular again?
So, like, when she when the moment where she says, maybe that's not what you're here to do, but that's exactly what I'm going to do. And then she walks up and
okay, so you're not talking about when No Man's battle has already started. You're talking about the moment right before it.
The moment right before, and then when she goes through the crossing.
Yeah, I think by having the crossing happen before the battle in the village, mm-hmm. that anticipation throughout, you get to continue to feel that without feeling like there's a climax there on the field where, you know, she's drawing all the fire and there's that line, right? You get to continue to build that anticipation leading up into the battle in the village. So it really prolongs this sort of three-scene sequence where they all feel, you know, there's, they all have their separate three moments, you know, in the trench versus crossing the channel versus in the village, but the anticipation continues to build throughout. So I guess that's why that was my go-to word, is anticipation. But if you're specifically talking about the moment right before she goes to the crossing, there it's like I hadn't had that spoiled for me yet. I know there was a lot of spoilers going around before the movie, and that moment hadn't been for me. So watching it for the first time in the theater, I didn't necessarily know exactly how that battle was going to go down, and it did feel early in the movie to where you sort of it's not that you think that there's going to be like, oh, it's, you know, it, there's not going to be a big win until the end. This will be a failure, whatever. It's just you don't necessarily know what to expect that early in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's like you sort of get this reassurance once she, you know, she puts on her Wonder Woman tiara and she's starting to climb the ladder and all that. You sort of get this reassurance that, like, this movie knows what it's doing. Like, this is going to be great. Like, no matter what happens, like, you just, it, there's this sense of confidence there that, like, goes beyond just her character. And you go from, I guess, not, anxiety is not the right word, but just sort of like wondering when something bad's going to happen to mm-hmm. just more like anticipation that something good is going to happen.
Right. I don't know. Like a nervous excitement, the kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Mm-hmm.
And you're right about how it continued into the village, and
right.
What I loved about, you know, that there was two scenes from three, but when she body checks the tank and then lifts it over her head,
right.
That's right out of, I don't know if you guys are have been reading it, but that's right in the early issues of the Injustice Gods Among Us video games.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene where she does exactly that. And I'm like, oh man, they ripped it right out of the comic. And then I love the part where she where she does the, you know, where she leaps onto the quasi. I think Steve was using the front of the tank as a shield so that she could jump and go onto the altar.
Yeah, echoing the island moment. Yeah.
Exactly. It echoes the island moment. And I'm like, I didn't think anything could get cooler than the Nomad, but this sequence keeps getting better and better and better, and I'm like, how can you not just be overwhelmed with just emotion, and not only emotion, but just excitement over this DC? This is some of the best stuff to me committed mm-hmm. to superhero filmmaking. It just, it's these are quintessential action scenes that I think should be not necessarily copied, but the template. You know how for years Superman the movie was a template for superhero movies?
Mm-hmm.
I think this movie, in terms of action shots, I think if every film should try and strive to have something, to have sequences with an anticipation level and a payoff of the No Man's Land and Village sequence. I think that should be the goal to achieve something of that caliber. Because it was fantastic. Jordan, what were your thoughts on the whole, on what we're talking about, the little sequences?
Okay. All right. First off, Adam, I got to say, as you like to say, it is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs that the Man of Steel flight sequence is not in your top three DCEU scenes.
I didn't say it wasn't there. It's there, damn it. It's right there.
You said it wasn't on your top three.
Okay. It may not be my top three, but look, here's my point. The fact that Wonder Woman, everybody knows that Batman and Superman are one and 1A to me. I grew up with these characters. Batman was the first movie I ever saw in theaters. Superman, my exposure was Lois and Clark, the Dean Cain version. Don't hold that against me. But it is what it is. I've loved these. And so the fact that two Wonder Woman sequences can displace any sequence with those two characters speaks to how much I love this movie. That's the point I'm trying to get across. But believe me, Man of Steel is right up there. I watch that flight sequence if that's the last thing I see. Well, hopefully it's not the last thing I see before I die. But if it was, it wouldn't be a bad way to go out. But anyway, go on, continue. Don't discredit my love of Man of Steel. We had a 3-hour podcast on the goddamn movie.
We did. I'm just giving you a hard time, Adam. It's all good.
At least one of my favorite scenes isn't from Catwoman.
And one of my favorite scenes is not from Catwoman
True.
Either.
Deny it all you want. Go ahead.
Oh,
stop
my
derailing
goodness.
The podcast. Keep going.
Okay. I want to echo pretty much everything you guys said. The No Man's Land sequence, it's one of the finest action sequences ever coming into film, superhero or otherwise. It's one of the finest action sequences ever put to film. I mean, it really is. I sort of talked about how Diana's mission statement, we heard it earlier when she's talking to Hippolyta and she's like, who would I be if I stayed? But here I feel like we sort of see the continuation of this where Steve is like, this is not what we came here to do. And she's like, well, this is what I came here to do. She came here to save people. And so she sees that woman there that's telling her what's happening. And she's like, we've got to help these people. And, you know, this is the, as I talked about earlier, this is the best part of Rupert Gregson-Williams' score as well. This is the part that we've got in our intro music when that score swells and she steps out of the trench and you see the slow-mo shot of the bullet racing at her and she deflects it and it's just, I mean, it's I get chills every time I watch it. I swear I was in tears the first time I saw this in the movie theater. And I guess the last thing I'm going to say, though, and this is a testament to how good this movie is, this is not even my favorite scene in the movie. We're going to get to that. But yeah, just a phenomenal, phenomenal scene.
Right. Okay, before we end up wrapping up and talking about our rating for this film, we have to talk about a little bit about the twist and Ares and the final battle.
So you're going to skip over what was my favorite scene.
Okay, what's your favorite scene? No, you listen. I set the table. We talk about it, and then you can. I'm not disqualifying you from bringing in whatever you jump off of what I say and go back and forth. I don't care, but you can bring it up. I'm not gonna skip over, but you can definitely bring it up. I'm just giving us a touch.
I'm just playing with you, man. Playing with you, man. Should I bring it up now or should I bring it up later, though?
It's up to you. Would you rather end up and close like be part of your wrap up portion of the episode, or do you want to spoil it now? It's up to you.
Okay, I'll say it now because it's in between the scene we just talked about the Ares thing. The scene that's my favorite scene in the movie is we touched on part of it earlier, or at least I did, I think. The scene where Steve and Diana are dancing in the that courtyard. Okay. And because I think that is what, like I said, this whole movie hinges on Diana and Steve's relationship, and that's why the end is in many ways so powerful, because at least I did, I got so invested in their relationship in this film, and it's because it's like in this scene where one of the lines that stands out to me so much is when Diana's like, well, is this what people do when it's not wartime? And he says, well, you know, he goes through, he talks about all these mundane things, eat breakfast, and you know, and she's like, and he's like, they start a family, you know, they have kids, and she's like, so what's that like? And he's like, I have no idea. And I just thought that was one of the most powerful, you know, lines in the movie. And just to see, you know, them really connect in that scene. You know, there's a great moment where she sees snow for the first time. And like I said, Charlie's singing. And it's just a really, like, you've just seen this amazing, phenomenal action sequence with No Man's Land. And you just get this really calm moment just where the movie really gets to breathe. And you see, you get to really connect, I feel like, with the two main actors. And I really think it's just a really calm moment, and you hear the music, and then it gets really quiet for a second too. It's just really peaceful, I thought. And of course, it also plays into why Diana is so, you know, distraught when they attack Veld with the gas, because it's like she's just been here, she's just danced with all these people, she's seen how peaceful this town can be, and she just saved it, and then that happens. But you know, this scene, just taking this as an isolated scene, I just think it's just this is why this movie works. It's this kind of scene where you really, I mean, yes, the action scenes in this movie are phenomenal. We get to see Wonder Woman kick ass, and it's awesome. But it's this scene where the movie really gets to breathe, and you really connect characters, that makes this movie so great, in my opinion.
All right, I'll give you, that was a good scene. I do enjoy that scene. So I'm glad you brought it up, because I did omit it. And here's why I omitted it. I'm Canadian, so the sight of snow only makes me think of winter. So it's not as beautiful to me, because I see snow way too. I mean, the scene is beautiful, but the idea of snow is not as beautiful to me as it is to other people because I see so much of it throughout the winter. So that's probably why I omitted it, just for not wanting to think about winter and snow. But so that's my defense, and I'm sticking to it.
Fair enough.
But let's get into, you know, we have to talk about Ares and the reveal, and also the third act, you know, battle and Steve's sacrifice. So let's do that. Again, I thought that I said previously that I was totally convinced that Ludendorff was Ares, and so that when it ends up being what was the character's
Sir Patrick Morgan, I believe.
Okay, yeah, it was Sir Patrick. I had no idea. I had no idea that it was going to be like I totally fooled me, and I like that it was somebody that was so physically unassuming and at the outset looks rather weak in a sense. So I like that dynamic. It added to the trickery. I did like, and the fact that he was like, he, as he went into his monologue, he did the whole thing of, you know, pulling the strings behind the scenes. It was very Lex Luthor-y in that sense, and it actually shows you how much of a, I'm talking about comic book Lex Luthor specifically, that when I can compare Lex Luthor to Ares, it shows you how much of a badass of a villain Lex Luthor can be. But what I liked about this, the whole Ares angle from the get-go, is that right from moment one in the film, Diana's convinced, you know, that Ares is the one at the root of this conflict. And it turns out that she was right. But I like that there was this back and forth of, you know, she wholeheartedly believes it, where there were moments where Steve's like, just, you know, play along that it is Ares, but then eventually he's
right.
Like, it's not Ares, it's us, you know, basically human beings can be terrible, blah, 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 blah. And for so long, Diana had that conviction that, no, it's not Ares. And then when she kills Ludendorff and she sees that humans are still going about with the war, she starts buying into that hopelessness kind of thing for a bit, where she's like, you people really are terrible. You know, like, my mother was right, blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, Ares. And even though Ares is sort of the culprit, he, you know, the idea that I just planted the seed, they're the ones that went through with it, doesn't let humanity off the hook. And I'm kind of glad that Patty Jenkins did it that way.
Yeah.
Because there's, again, in the fantastical, there's a legitimacy to that by saying, I just gave them all the tools. They're the ones who went about their way and decided to go this course of actions. I also liked the whole sequence where he takes Diana into the dream sequence and like shows her that he wants to sort of remake the Earth as a home for the gods. That whole dream sequence thing was cool. And it was very reminiscent of when Zod did the same thing with Superman in Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Before he got covered in the skulls and he was wearing the black suit. So I love the parallels of that.
Yeah.
And even how Ares was going back and talking about how his battle with Zeus and they show that he had been, you know, stripped of his powers and defeated, and like all the flashbacks. I loved all that aspect of it. When he goes fully armored, I dug his look, but I kind of wish that it was shot in a clearer way where it was where everything wasn't covered in smoke and darkness and red. I wish we had a clear picture of that. I think it would have been the battle sequence would have been even more powerful if it wasn't, you know,
a clear picture of Ares' armor,
like even their battle, like his battle, yeah, with Wonder Woman. It was,
yeah,
covered in this cloud of darkness and fire, and I mean, it's a cool visual, but I want to see, like, we're waiting so long to see Ares, like all this build up and then you don't get a, you know what I mean?
I mean, I think they were trying to make sure that the whole fight had an ethereal quality where right. it didn't feel like, you know, two humans in a super suit fighting, as it might be, you know, in a movie where it is two humans in a super suit fighting, right?
Good point.
And so with Wonder Woman, I think that it's a little bit easier because, you know, while she does have a bit of battle armor, it's mostly, you know, her superpower. You know, like she has her bracers, but it's the superpowers that come out of the bracers and stuff. And with Ares, I think just because of the way they were portraying his powers, and because he was in armor, I just think they wanted to make sure the focus wasn't on the armor, so that we're focused on the fact that these are both, you know, demigods, if that's the term we want to use for them, and it's not about the armor that they're wearing. I think that's the focus, but I do right. get from like a geeky costuming standpoint, I kind of want to see the armor better
yeah,
too.
Because when I saw him, I'm like, he looks cool. Like I like his look. Right. I wish I saw at least for a little bit longer, a little bit more of it. And I also, you know, to me, the other thing that I loved about the whole ending was two things. Steve's final sacrifice and that whole bit that they did beforehand where he says sort of his goodbye to her and he's like, I can save, how was the line? I could save today, but you could save the world or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Right. And then he tells her that he loves her and he goes up and he explodes, you know, the plane explodes. It's full of
right.
gas and whatnot.
Right.
That whole bit and the fact that, at first, you couldn't hear what they were saying, but then later on in the film,
right.
when she's battling Ares, she remembers what he was saying to her.
Yeah.
And the fact that her whole, like, see, a lot of people, I know some people that took issue to the fact that they're saying, oh, it was her love of Steve Trevor. Basically, her love of a man that made her, you know, come to her ultimate conclusions. But I disagree with that. I think it's Steve reinforced her initial beliefs of humanity.
You know, I agree with you to a large extent. I guess I should say I want to agree with you. I want to interpret it that way, so I just kind of do interpret it that way.
Okay.
That it was, you know, Steve's sacrifice is, it's a human sacrifice. It's a human displaying heroism, right? And so that kind of gesture sort of reaffirmed her faith in humanity, right? And, you know, she realizes humans can choose to be bad or humans can choose to be good, right? And to great extents, to great extremes. And it wasn't just like, oh, the love of my life died. I guess I got to go blow up the world now. You know what I mean?
Right.
However, it's really the one area of the film where I guess I do have criticism. It's hard to say criticism because, you know, I loved it regardless.
Right.
I loved that scene and that part regardless. But I think, you know, I really think the issue would have been better resolved if you just, you know, just backtrack in the movie to the part where they're like doing their little dance in the village, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they do the room part.
Right.
Just take out the bedroom scene, and that would have completely changed the scene where Steve's sacrifice happens
right.
to where we know for sure that your interpretation and the interpretation that I want to have is true, because it would have just been, you know, there could have been hints of romance and they have
right,
wonderful
yeah.
chemistry, whatever. But if it had never been romance sort of acted on, then we can still sort of believe this is just about the fact that, like, you know, he's a human that she sort of admires and sees humans can be a hero. And, you know, perhaps there's romantic inklings, whatever the case may be. But it's because this human did this sacrifice as a hero that, you know, she's inspired, rather than this is somebody who we already concretely see on screen was like a love, a romantic
right,
interest.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think you're interpreting it right. I just wish that had been clearer. And I think if they had taken out the bedroom scene, it would have been clearer.
Right. I mean, part of it is because she loved him and that, you know, there is a romantic aspect to it. But I'm saying I don't think that's her sole justification for coming to her ultimate realization. And
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
that ultimate realization is what she says to Ares, is that, yes, humans can be both, but you know, when she says, I ultimately choose love, it's about love. It's your choice to love, right? That the fact that a superhero film really emphasizes, and you have the hero character outright telling the villain, like, that's the message they're sending. You know, all too often, I think these movies get so caught up in the whole Rama's, I was like, yeah, let's show, you know, cool action sequences and this and that. I think the general core message of the film and the way they ended it was unique to most superhero films, I think. And that's why I love that bit of dialogue at the end, because it was such a, you know, I thought it was, like I said, the best word I can use to describe it is unique. I know there is love, you know, you see that in, you know, BVS with Lois and Clark's relationship. That's
right.
His love for her is more of a, like, that's more of his driving force, because it's his, she's his connection to humanity, like her and his mother,
right,
obviously. But I'm saying with Wonder Woman, the line of dialogue she gave at the end made me believe it was more of a general sense, a more of a general theme than specifically.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I do think it is more of a general sense. I just think that wasn't quite as clear as it could be. Because if it is still open to interpretation to where people, like I'm with you, I'm interpreting it the same way you are. But if it's so open to interpretation where there are people being like, oh, wait, is she just reacting to the fact that the love of her life died? Then I think it just needed a tiny bit more clarity. And there's different ways that could have been done.
The flashback could have been different. You're right. Yeah, I can see that totally working a little bit better. Jordan, what did you think of the Ares reveal and the final battle?
Yeah, so here's what I'll say about the Ares reveal. I knew about it going into the movie because it, somewhere on some casting, I don't know whether it was IMDb, but they had David Thewlis listed as Ares somewhere.
Bastards.
So I wasn't sure if I totally, because I'd also seen Ludendorff, or I'd also seen Danny Houston listed as Ares somewhere else. So I wasn't totally, I wasn't totally sure that it was going to be Professor Lupin. But I had a very good idea in my head that there was a good chance that it was going to be him. But when I look at the movie, if I pretend that I didn't know that going in, I think that the reveal worked. So like, if that makes sense, I didn't know about it, but like, if I look at it and I look
if
at the movie,
okay.
Right. So I think that it did from that sense, it did work. But even so, he was my favorite villain out of the three in this movie. I thought that David Thewlis, with one exception, there's this one line when he's like, when he says something to the effect of, then I will destroy you. And he says something like that to Wonder Woman that I thought was kind of over the top. But for the most part, his acting performance was very good once he made the change. I thought it was really creepy when they're like in that, you know, tower sort of. And he's like, as soon as she crosses like the sight line so she can see him, he like flips so that he's on the other side of the window. I thought that was really cleverly shot because it made it kind of creepy the way they did that.
Right.
I did enjoy him quite a bit as a villain, and I thought that I understand what you're saying about sort of wanting a better shot with the armor at him, but for me, I thought that I thought for the most part it looked really cool. I mean, it was very comic accurate, really, especially once he drew. I thought it was really cool.
That's why I wanted to see more of it. I'm like, look, it's so comic accurate. Show me more of it.
Yeah, I know. I feel. I feel you on that. Like, I thought it was really cool, especially how he like drew. He like took his fingers and he sort of like etched the sort of his mask together, like so it looked like it does in the comics. And I thought it was awesome. And really, that whole final battle. I mean, yeah, the No Man's Land battle that was earlier in the film is the best action sequence in the film. But this, I've heard this battle get quite a bit of flack, actually. Like, a lot of people say that it's their least favorite part of this movie. For personally, I loved it. I thought especially like there's that part once Steve Trevor makes his sacrifice and Diana just lets loose and you see she's like just tearing through all those soldiers, like knocking them out of the way, and there's like all this sort of fire coming up around her. I mean, I just thought that was one of the coolest things I'd ever seen, one of the coolest action shots of Wonder Woman. So
if I could jump in there for a second, yeah. I think the reason people say that the No Man's Land scene is the best scene in the movie is because it's the scene where we as the audience feel the best during the movie. It's the scene where we're sort of reassured that this is going to be great, right? And by the end, we're already reassured. You know, we've already seen the movie, you know, by the time we get to the final battle, and we already know it's great. And, you know, we've been through, you know, sad scenes like Steve's sacrifice and all of that, right? And so it's more mixed emotions at that point, whereas during No Man's Land, it's sort of that first rise. And I think that it was, I guess not necessary, but smart to have the No Man's Land scene set early in the movie, because that immediately sort of puts the audience's fears aside of like, is this going to be a good movie or not? You know what I mean? Like, because we all go into that worried, right? Like, you know, like I knew I was going to love it, but is this going to be a good, good movie that everybody's going to love? And by the time you get to the No Man's Land scene, you're sort of reassured. And once you get that reassurance, you can kind of go through the rest of the movie enjoying it in a different way. But you don't get that same initial feeling of like, this is the first battle when you get to the last battle. But it's still a wonderful battle. It's really well done. Sorry for interrupting you. Back
no,
to
you're
Jordan.
Good. You're good. Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, I agree. The No Man's Land scene is the best act. It's not my favorite scene overall in the movie, but it is my favorite action in the movie. So I agree that it's the best action sequence in the movie. I'm just saying I hear that this – in opposition to it, I hear this action sequence get a lot of flack. Now, I agree that it's not as good as the No Man's Land scene. I just feel that this scene on its own, though, is still really, really good. So, certainly the No Man's Land scene, I would agree, is the best action scene. But I think this one it's the second best one, probably.
Absolutely.
And I love it. So.
Yeah, me too.
And then, as we mentioned, the film ends with, the war is won, and they see the wall of the fallen heroes, and there's a picture of Steve, and she's there looking at the picture, and then we pick up with modern day Diana, and she's responding via email to Bruce Wayne. And it's funny, when she rounded the when she's in Wonder Woman gear and she's rounding the rooftop of the building, for a second I'm like, okay, she's going to round the corner of this building and Batman's going to be perched waiting for her and they're going to go off. And part of me was like, okay, the Batman fan in me was like, okay, Batman's going to be around that corner. Batman's going to be around that corner. And then he wasn't. And I'm like, okay, I'm strangely good with this because it's her movie and I don't need to see him right now. So I had part of me wanted to see him, but part of me is like, don't be there, be there. I was going through very mixed emotions at that time. But then the movie was over, and I'm like, damn, why did that have to end? But with that, I think we should give our final thoughts, and then we're going to rate the movie and how we've now decided to rate the movie thanks to a scoring system given to us by our last guest. What we're going to do is, because he suggested we rated out of, like, instead of 10 out of 10, there's plainly 10 out of 10. Take something from this film. So in this case, I'm going to choose to take, like, from 1 to 10, like, one lasso of truth out of 10, or, 1 to 10. So one lasso of truth out of 10 or whatever have you. So I'm going to use the lasso of truth as my, out of 10 placeholder. So you can choose whatever you want, Cammy. It could be one Wonder Woman tiara out of 10, one bracelet, whatever it is. And that's mm-hmm. That's how we're going to go about with the rating. But let's give our final thoughts and then a rating. So, Cammy, since you've been an awesome guest, why don't you start us off with final thoughts and a rating?
I would love to. I guess my final thoughts for this movie is, like I mentioned, like a couple little nitpicks. And other than that, I basically loved the movie. Like, I think I would rate it probably like a 9.8 baby Dianas out of 10.
That's a good one. I like that.
But, I named like a couple little critiques, but I think one of the things that I sort of saw a lot afterwards as sort of a loving critique was, oh, there was so much more they could do. They could have done this. They could have done that. They could have introduced this character or referenced that item or referenced this part of, Wonder Woman's mythology and backstory and everything. And that's more of it's not a critique. It's just this sense of hopefulness, and that there's so many, if you take things like whether Marvel, DC, anything that, I'll use Spider-Man, for example, that's had like millions of movies.
You can use a Marvel reference.
I'll go ahead.
It's not taboo. I saw you struggling trying to, should I use it? Should I? It's not a bad one. You can use.
Okay. So, with Spider-Man, for example, where he's had like trilogies and reincarnations and movies and all this sort of stuff, you know, there's a lot, they've had a lot of screen time to explore. And with Wonder Woman, you know, in this incarnation, we certainly haven't. We've had one movie. And so it's great that we're sort of left wanting more, because there is so much more screen time she could have. This is one movie. This isn't even one full trilogy or one full incarnate, you know. So I that's sort of a, it feels almost like a critique, but it's just sort of like this hopefulness that comes with the end of the movie, that there could be more, or the things that you're wishing for, like when you're like, oh, Batman could be right around the corner, like you just, you know, we're dying to see Wonder Woman and Batman interact more, and Wonder Woman and Flash interact, and all of those. It's the sense of, you know, I used the word anticipation earlier when you were asking about the No Man's Land scene. You almost continue that sense of anticipation towards the end of the movie, not towards future scenes, because, you know, sadly the movie ends and we don't have any more until next year.
Next week.
Wonder Woman next, but yeah, not another sequel.
Yeah, true enough.
Yeah. Or this weekend, I guess, upcoming weekend.
By the time the listeners hear this, they will have seen more Wonder Woman. So
that's true. That's true. But in terms of a full Wonder Woman only story,
yes,
you know,
you're right.
You kind of have that anticipation at the end of the movie of like, we have this heroine now, and we're going to get to see more stories. And I think that's sort of the final thought I was left with when seeing the movie. And 9.8 out of 10.
All right. And those are 9.8 baby Dianas out of 10.
So yes.
We're really going with that little girl. She was great.
She was wonderful. Yeah.
All right, Jordan, let's hear it. What's your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah. I mean, I really like this movie. It's just, it's such a good origin film for the character. And I mean, it really, like I said, I loved what we saw of Gal Gadot in the role in Batman v Superman, and then this just solidified that in my mind, that she just is phenomenal in the role. And just seeing her in her first live action film, it really is a really, really remarkable film. Just pretty much excellent performances for the most part from the cast, and I just was really impressed with several of the action scenes in this movie. I was really impressed with how invested I got in the characters, how invested I got in Diana and Steve's relationship. Like I said, I have a little bit of a issue with the villains in this movie, but overall, just a really, really good movie. For me, it is 9 outfits that Diana decided not to wear out of 10.
That's, you know what, for you know, for all the crap I give you on the show, I gotta give you credit for that one.
That Thank you.
Good job.
That's
that
an
one.
Excellent rating system.
Good job. Look, I'm, again, it's one of the, I said it earlier, it was my favorite film of the summer. It was generally one of the most joyous times I had in a superhero film. For me, it is one of the best, if not, and this changes on and off depending on my mood, but one of the best, if not the best superhero origin film of all time, in my opinion. And like everything, the action scenes were captivating. The cast was, you know, infectiously good. The story, you know, really captured your attention from moment one. And my nitpicks were so minor that they weren't enough to detract from the film at all. And they weren't enough for me, honestly, to take even a point off. So with all that being said, I'm going to give it 10 lassos of truth out of 10. Best film of the DC connected universe.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thoughts.
I was nodding, and then I realized you couldn't see me nodding, so I will verbalize my agreement.
thank you for nodding. Unfortunately, our listeners did not send us any questions. Shame on you this week. So I want to thank Cammy for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed your experience, because if I'm remembering our lineup, Jordan, Cammie's going to join us again. Is that correct?
Did we solidify that yet? I'd love to have you back on, Cammie. I think we were talking about the Arrowverse Invasion crossover to have you back on.
Yeah, I think we did talk about that. I would love to.
Okay, so I was right. Okay, so then, and it seems like she enjoyed herself. So she will be back for the Arrowverse Crisis on Earth X crossover. So that's good news. And again, we had so much fun. And we hope.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for having me. I appreciated it. It was a blast. And I really like talking about Wonder Woman. So thank you for indulging me.
Thank you for coming on. And I'm sure our listeners will enjoy this conversation. If not, for not having to hear Jordan and myself for the whole time, they get to hear somebody else again. So it's, providing different voices each week is a good thing.
Is there anything you want to plug, Cammie?
Yeah, is there your podcast? Anything you wanna
plug about myself? I guess I could self promo for a second if you want. If any of you guys do watch Arrow and you want to hear more of my terrible, terrible voice, you can check out the podcast Arrow Squad at arrowsquad.com. I'm a co-host on that. We review Arrow every week. And also I do live reviews after Arrow and sometimes some other shows on my YouTube channel. All of this, you could probably just find it on my Twitter. I tweet about everything and I live tweet a lot, so if you're trying to find any of that, that's where you'll find it, and that's at Cammie and Ray, which pretty straightforward at.
Perfect segue, and we will put your Twitter handle in the show notes so that people will be able to follow you if they so choose. I do, so you should too.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. I live tweet so much. You probably don't want to follow me, but if you want to glance at my Twitter for a second, you can at least find it there.
No, I don't mind it. My thing is, as long as you don't spoil Justice League for me, we're good.
I will definitely not be spoiling Justice League or any movie. I definitely follow spoiler rules for movies. I probably do spoil television, though, so enter at your own risk.
At least I know what to look forward to each week on Arrow before I sit down. And I usually PBR it, so it's like, If I do glance at your Twitter, I may see something. But usually what happens is before Arrow's on, there's a hockey game on. So I'm probably watching that. So I probably won't see this player anyway till after the fact. So it's all good. Jordan, if anybody wants to follow you and listen to your insightful comments on things not including Batman and Robin, Thirst, or Catwoman, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram. My handle on both is at BatfanJordanV. And come tell me about your love for the Smallville episode Thirst, because we, with Adam's rantings about how bad it is, we need more love for that episode.
And if you do like Thirst, please don't follow me. No, I'm just kidding. If you want to follow me and see the wonderful gifts of The Rock rolling his eyes at every time Jordan talks about these terrible episodes, you can follow me at Superhero Sci-Fi, and we can chat about superheroes and whatever else you want to chat about. Until next time, have a good weekend, and enjoy Justice League, because next time you hear us, we'll be talking about Justice League. So long, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.